dawning days of the Cold War, but in the last few years, the relationship between the U.S. and Turkey has soured. When the Soviet Union collapsed, so did the common denominator in the U.S.-Turkish alliance. And now, the two allies have major differences over Iraq. Turks don't think the U.S. is doing enough to combat the Kurdish terrorist organization, the PKK. It's been launching attacks on Turkey from its base in northern Iraq. American lawmakers added fuel to the fire when they proposed a resolution recognizing as genocide the mass killing of Armenians by the Ottoman Empire in 1915. Days later, the Turkish parliament authorized military attacks on PKK bases in Iraq. But for the time being, the military is holding its fire. And inside Turkey, politicians are now more responsive to the electorate than ever before. If America wants to preserve its alliance with Turkey, it needs to take Turkish public opinion into account. Today on the program, I'll be examining the history of the U.S.-Turkish relationship, and I'll take a look back at Turkey's decision not to allow U.S. troops through the country at the start of the Iraq War. My special co-host for the program is one of Turkey's leading broadcasters, CNN Turk's Mithat Bereket. He'll tell us about Turkey's ongoing struggle with its Kurdish population and how that's affecting its relationship with Washington. But first, Mithat takes us inside Turkey's domestic political struggle. National elections earlier this year caused a lot of soul-searching in this country. Mithat explains the deeper issues underlying the party politics. We join Mithat Bereket at a political rally in Turkey's capital city.
On September the 9th, 10,000 members of Turkey's Cumhuriyet Halk Partisi, or CHP, gathered outside the party's Ankara headquarters. They were there to protest the CHP leadership and its poor showing in July's parliamentary elections. This year marked the party's seventh consecutive loss at the national level. People came from all over the country to be there. This man traveled almost 300 miles from the town of Tokat to attend the demonstration. Amid the sea of Turkish flags, he explains why he came out to protest.
Our country and this party are not well managed, and we didn't deserve this. Our country has to stay democratic, and we have to stay true to Ataturk's principles.
He is referring to the principles of Kemalism. The 9th of September marks the anniversary of the founding of the CHP. Established by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk in 1923, the CHP was the nation's first ruling party. And as president of a CHP-led government, Atatürk developed the Kemalist ideology that set the modern Turkish nation on its course. The party still sees itself as the keeper of the flame. Altan Öymen is vice chairman and one-time leader of the CHP.
We are defenders of these principles. The Republican principles, which are the backbones of our society, starting with secularism.
Secularism is a defining principle of the nation. Soner Çağatay directs the Turkish research program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
In the Western world, there are two forms of secularism. I call them the European form and the American form. The European form, a better word for it, is actually laïcité. European secularism, laïcité, arose as a political movement against the domination of politics by one faith, Catholicism in France, Islam in Turkey. It has pushed religion out of politics. So whereas American secularism means freedom of religion, European secularism means freedom from religion. This is exactly what we see in Turkey.
And following the recent elections, the country is facing an identity crisis. The real issue, though, is not the CHP's diminishing relevance to the Turkish voter. It is the fact that the party they lost to has its roots in political Islam. Adalet ve Kalkınma Partisi, or AKP, is an offshoot of the Islamist Welfare Party. That party was banned by Turkey's constitutional court because of its overtly religious platform. The AKP has been in power since 2002. This year, it was re-elected in a landslide. It won 47% of the vote and used that mandate to nominate one of its own ministers to the office of president. Both current Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdoğan and President Abdullah Gül were members of the Welfare Party. The AKP and its leaders have renounced their Islamist roots and proclaimed their commitment to Turkey's secular constitution. But many Turks wonder if the party has really changed. Their concerns are heightened by the fact that Abdullah Gül's wife, the new First Lady, wears the Islamic headscarf. This covering, known as the turban, is considered a religious symbol and is banned from universities and government buildings. Atilla Askar is president of Koç University.
That's one thing that bothers many people. It will appear like that ideology has prevailed, like Turkey is retreating back and giving up on its fundamental principles of its republic. So that's one very sore point, because Turkey, that was leader of modernity in its region.
And for Atatürk, modernity and secularism went hand in hand. Soner Çağatay.
Atatürk saw Turkey's Ottoman past as backward. For him, modernizing Turkey meant Europeanizing Turkey. In other words, getting rid of the Ottoman institutions and putting in place European institutions. So the idea of a nation state, the idea of a centralized state, the idea of a secular state were tantamount to Atatürk's vision of a European Turkey.
For many Turks, the Islamic headscarf is a powerful symbol of the divide between Turkey's eastern past and Atatürk's western vision for the country. Following Abdullah Gül's nomination to the presidency in April 2007, over a million people around the country took to the streets in protest. Bedri Baykam is one of Turkey's best-known contemporary artists.
There is a touch of the brushstroke and the ease, and there is erotism and humor.
He founded the Association for Atatürk's Thought, and he helped organize the anti-Gül rallies in Istanbul.
So now the Islamists control the parliament, and they control the presidential palace. And now there's a veiled woman sitting in the palace of Atatürk, and that's a big offense to us, the secular Democrat Republicans. And that is a very big offense to Atatürk's legacy.
The question of Atatürk's legacy and how to continue his Kemalist vision is at the crux of the current debate. Egemen Bağış is the vice chairman of the AKP. He agrees that Turkey needs to keep faith with its founding father. However,
different people interpret the founding principles of Turkey differently. I believe the founder of our republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, and his comrades wanted to see a prosperous Turkey where people could live their lives the way they wanted to, and that they were integrated with the rest of the world. This is what AK Parti is doing today. We're doing what's right for Turkey, just like Atatürk did what was right for Turkey back at his time.
According to this view, the Kemalist principles, including that of secularism, were merely instrumental towards Atatürk's broader goal. Ahmet Kuyaş is a historian of Turkey's Republican Revolution. He teaches at Istanbul's Galatasaray University.
There aren't any principles. You know, Kemalism is not actually an ideology. It's a movement to make Turkey a modern nation. Kemalism is a modernization process.
Mustafa Akyol is the deputy editor of the Turkish Daily News. He says what was necessary for modernization in the early days of the Turkish Republic doesn't apply to today's Turkey, a nation poised for membership in the European Union.
If you cling to the definition of modernity, which was accepted during Atatürk's time, you would say Turkey is shifting from that. But Turkey's so-called Kemalists don't want to update their definition of modernity. Now, today, the rising values in the modern world is like individual freedoms, limited government, and the individual's right to, you know, shape his life, and diversity. These are new ideas, and I think accepting them would not be abandoning Atatürk's views, just updating his views.
One of the first things that Mustafa Akyol would like to see updated is Turkey's strict interpretation of secularism.
In Turkey, we have a secularism which is not very tolerant towards religious freedom. A woman, for example, who wears the headscarf is banned from universities and any kind of education. AKP wants to change that, and it wants to give freedom to the headscarf. They just want more space and freedom for the religious people in society.
This push for freedom, says the AKP's Egemen Bağış, isn't only about religion.
AK Parti represents Turkey's aspirations to become more democratic. AK Parti represents the Turkish nation's demand to have more freedom of speech, more freedom of conscience, and more freedom of choice. Our understanding of religion is an individual phenomenon. The government doesn't have the right to tell people which religion they should subscribe to or and how much of that they should utilize. We're making Turkey more democratic, not more Islamic.
And that's an argument that appeals to many Turks. In Istanbul's Sultanahmet neighborhood, the city's ancient hippodrome is hosting Ramadan celebrations every night of the month-long holiday. Families gather in the parks outside the Blue Mosque to break their day of fasting, then spend the evening at the temporary fairground listening to music and snacking from the many food stalls. This 27-year-old woman wears the headscarf.
Life is not equal in Turkey. I don't say anything to people who don't wear the headscarf. We are a democratic country, so everyone should do what they want. The scarf is my identity. In America, it's not a problem. Why is it a problem in Turkey?
For Soner Çağatay, the problem is that the headscarf lies on a genuine fault line of Turkish politics.
Either you look at this from the perspective of religious practice, or you look at this from the perspective of symbolism. I think it is both. And that's why I think Turkey is in a very tough time resolving this issue, because it's really gray. It's not about black and white. And until and unless Turks of all colors come together and discuss that this issue is symbolically important, but also religiously important, it's going to be very hard for the country to get a way out of this conundrum.
At a cafe in Istanbul's Beyoğlu district, Ahmet Kuyaş says the country is finally having this discussion, and it's thanks to the political turmoil stirred up by the AKP's election. Beyoğlu lies on the other side of the Golden Horn from Sultanahmet. It is the heart of the city's thriving nightlife. Even during Ramadan, the cafes and bars are full.
Nowadays, because we had this conservative party, which had a more Islamic discourse in power, the proponents of true laïcité have become more vocal, and we started a discussion that we should have closed some 50 years ago.
But let's not forget, says Hakan Yılmaz, this issue goes beyond political symbols and discussions. Turkey's struggle is ultimately about the kind of society Turks want to live in. He teaches political science at Boğaziçi University.
It's not a matter of macro politics. Whether you are beaten up because you eat something during the Ramadan, whether you are, as a woman, your rights are curtailed because other people don't like that you are so free. That is the battleground where so-called Kemalism and the Islamic conservatism would confront one another. And that's where the true fights would be fought. And I think that we have to fight these fights. This is where we have to protect our rights, and that's where they have to protect their own rights, and that is where a more civilized Turkey would emerge. But it hasn't yet emerged. We are on the way of learning all these issues.
And Atilla Askar is optimistic that Turkey will meet the challenge. In the end, he says, Turks still share a lot of common ground.
The republic is well-rooted, the republican values of secularism are well-rooted. In fact, the secularists don't know how Muslim they are, and the devoted Muslims don't know how secular they are.
For America Abroad, I am Mithat Bereket.
I'm Ray Suarez. Coming up, we look back at the close alliance between the U.S. and Turkey, and how that alliance has recently run off course. That's ahead on Allies at a Crossroad, Turkey and the U.S. from America Abroad.
Information to the public during emergencies. This was a test.
I am Mithat Bereket in Istanbul, and this is America Abroad. On this hour of the program, Allies at a Crossroad, Turkey and the U.S. For a look at the history of the Turkish-American relationship, I'm joined by America Abroad anchor Ray Suarez. And Ray, the anchor of this relationship, has been the critical military alliance between the two countries.
Very true. In the aftermath of the Second World War, the Turks were looking for a strong power to support them against the Soviet Union, and the U.S. was looking for a reliable ally that could protect the southern flank of the NATO alliance.
Though the strategic relationship was strong, relations between the Turkish and American people have at times been strained. Turks and Americans have not known each other well, and in this segment, we will hear a few Turkish songs that reflect the changing and ambivalent attitude Turks have had toward the U.S. over the last 60 years.
Dünyayı daralttın Amerika. Her yerden kovuldun Amerika.
Sonunda bizden... Today, the Turkish-American relationship is at a crossroad, when for so many reasons it should be strong and united. The generals have remained in the barracks. Turkey is looking west to the European Union and is a more stable and prosperous country than it was during the Cold War. But the common strategic outlook the two countries shared during the Cold War has been replaced by friction over U.S. policy in the Middle East. And now some in the United States have begun to wonder if Turkey, under its new government, remains as committed as it says it's been to secularism and Western values over the last 80 years. Those values were forged at the birth of the Turkish Republic in 1923, under the leadership of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. The founder of modern Turkey rose from the chaos of the collapsing Ottoman Empire and fashioned a secular republic and a new nationalism where Europe meets Asia.
I think that the importance of Atatürk and the foundation of the Turkish Republic is absolutely critical.
Bruce Kuhneholm is the director of the Institute of Public Policy and a professor of history at Duke University.
First of all, he was the one who led the War of Liberation in Turkey against Russia, Italy, Britain, France, and ultimately Greece. And he, because of that role, he had the legitimacy to carry out a vision. He modeled Turkey on the French nation state, and he based citizenship on individual identity.
Under Ataturk's 15-year rule, Constantinople was renamed Istanbul and became a westernized city of modern, well-planned buildings. He banned harems, gave Turkish women suffrage at the polls, and equal educational opportunities under foreign teachers. Impatient with former methods, Ataturk banished ancient ways, substituting machinery in an oriental land. For the first time, girls mingled with boys in the schools, reading a Latin alphabet instead of the unwieldy Arabic. In every way, he emphasized the change from the old Turkey to the new.
The new Turkey faced a major threat soon after the Second World War ended. It was a new battle between Soviet communism and American democracy, and Turkey stood on the front line of that Cold War. President Truman spoke before Congress in the spring of 1947.
I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures. If Turkey is to have the assistance it needs, the United States must supply it. We are the only country able to provide that help. Should we fail to aid Greece and Turkey in this fateful hour, the effect will be far-reaching.
The Truman Doctrine committed U.S. forces to combating communist advances throughout the free world. Turkey would be a critical bulwark in the effort to contain communism. In 1950, that containment doctrine was challenged, not in the Middle East, but in East Asia.
By Generals MacArthur and Bradley, comes news that communist troops have invaded southern Korea. In swift response, President Truman has ordered United States Sea and Air Forces to give cover and support to the South Korean troops.
The U.S. and its United Nations allies responded by beating back the communist attack. One of the most important allies was Turkey. Bruce Kuhneholm.
The Turks, they made a commitment of a Turkish combat brigade that ultimately got to be about 7,000 people in size. They acquitted themselves well during the Korean War. MacArthur called them the bravest of the brave. They suffered something like 3,000 casualties. Now, why did they do this? What they were really interested in was demonstrating to the West the importance of their capabilities. And once the Korean War happened, all of a sudden, Turkey's role both as a European and Near Eastern power and its role in the defense of both those areas became something that the United States supported. And as a result, they supported their membership in NATO.
America, America.
In 1952, the Western powers invited Turkey to join an exclusive club, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and for the next decade, the friendship between the U.S. and Turkey bloomed. In 1963, President John F. Kennedy spoke on the 25th anniversary of Ataturk's death.
I am proud that the United States can be a partner in this alliance, linking us to the country of Ataturk and to the ideals which Ataturk helped establish in Turkey and the world.
But the honeymoon didn't last. In December of that year, the small island nation of Cyprus caused big problems in U.S.-Turkish relations.
Once again, the powder keg that is Cyprus threatens to blow the whole world into war. Once again, houses are left in flames. Cypriots killed or wounded, this time from bombings by Turkish planes. The raids were ordered by Ankara to protect, it said, the constitutional rights of Turkish Cypriots that are threatened by Greek Cypriots.
Ankara backed the outnumbered Turkish Cypriots with aerial attacks and threatened to send troops to the island. Athens made it clear it would not stand by in the face of Turkish aggression. NATO allies stood on the brink of all-out war. President Johnson then sent a harshly worded letter to the Turks. In it, he cast into doubt the U.S. protection of Turkey in the event the Soviet Union took action against the Turks. The Johnson letter shook the Turks' faith in the NATO alliance and caused a major rift in U.S.-Turkish relations. An uneasy peace was eventually restored on the island, but Turkish anger at America's role in the Cyprus conflict lingered. Again, Bruce Cunaholm.
I went to teach in Turkey in 1964, shortly after the Johnson letter. And Turks in the hinterlands would look at me and point thumbs up saying, Kennedy, and then they'd turn thumbs down, Johnson. And they had that basic perception. And they'd always say, well, we like you, you're a good person, but what your government has done isn't right.
The issue of Cyprus flared up again in 1974 when a Greek junta led a coup against the government of Cyprus. Turkey responded by invading the island and helped establish a Turkish mini-state in northern Cyprus. The U.S. Congress, in turn, leveled an arms embargo against Turkey. The embargo further soured the Turkish public's perception of America. For their part, many Americans saw Turkey as an exotic and backward land. The 1978 film Midnight Express was a huge success in America. It cast a harsh light on Turkey and the Turkish system of justice.
I just wish you could be standing where I'm standing right now and feel what that feels like, because then you would know something that you don't know, Mr. Prosecutor. Mercy. You would know that the concept of a society is based on the quality of that mercy, its sense of fair play, its sense of justice.
Although Turkey seemed foreign to many Americans, it remained a critical ally throughout the Cold War. Between 1980 and 1990, the U.S. exported more than $4.5 billion worth of arms to Turkey. But when the Soviet Union disintegrated, so did the strategic interests that had united the two countries. Saddam Hussein's 1990 incursion into Kuwait presented a new opportunity for cooperation. Turkish President Turgut Özal backed the U.S. effort to beat back Saddam's forces. After the war, President George H.W. Bush traveled to Turkey. He thanked President Özal in a speech that reverberated through the Dolmabahçe Palace, overlooking the Bosporus Straits.
It is fitting to speak about the enduring partnership that binds our two nations. All during the world's effort to use diplomacy to get Iraq's brutal dictator to remove his forces from Kuwait, and then all during Desert Shield and Desert Storm, President Özal and I were in constant touch. No ally was more solid than Turkey.
The Gulf War demonstrated to U.S. policymakers that Turkey could still be a valuable ally in a post-Cold War world. And in the 1990s, the two countries worked together to end conflict in the Balkans and to bring new energy resources from the Caspian region online. Then in 1999, the U.S. helped Turkey capture Abdullah Öcalan, the longtime leader of the Kurdish separatist organization known as the PKK. That same year, a devastating earthquake struck Turkey. President Clinton traveled to the country to express America's resolve to aid the Turkish people. It was a high watermark in U.S.-Turkish relations.
I want you to know that we in the United States will do everything we can to help you until your lives return to normal. And I just want to urge you to keep your spirits up, keep the smiles on your children's faces, keep helping the people who lost their loved ones in the earthquake, and know that together we will get through this to better days. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
After the attacks of September 11th, Turkey looked like it would become a critical ally in the war on terror. The U.S. celebrated Turkey's modern and secular Muslim democracy as the alternative to the dangerous fundamentalism of Osama bin Laden and his ilk. But politics inside Turkey were changing. The Justice and Development Party, or the AK Party, took power in November 2002 elections. It advocated a more visible role for Islam in Turkish public life, a stance that for some Turks, and many in the West, appeared to be a departure from Turkey's secular constitution. Less than 5 months later, the AK Party-dominated parliament bowed to overwhelming popular pressure when it rebuffed the American request to send troops through Turkey to attack Iraq. The vote made many Americans question the reliability of their Turkish ally. In 2004, President Bush traveled to Istanbul and tried to smooth over the recent problems in U.S.-Turkish relations.
Democracy does not involve automatic agreement with other democracies. Free governments have a reputation for independence, which Turkey has certainly earned. And yet in the end, the disagreements of the moment are far outweighed by the ideals we share.
Throughout the Cold War, common interests and a common threat helped unite the U.S. and Turkey. But today, the future of the alliance is in doubt. Since the invasion of Iraq, Turkey and the U.S. have argued over the status of Kurds in northern Iraq. More recently, the proposed Armenian Genocide Bill in the U.S. Congress unleashed a storm of protest and anger on the streets of Turkey and did significant damage to diplomatic relations between the two countries. It's uncertain today if both sides will be able to identify a set of common interests and enough shared values to rebuild a strong American-Turkish relationship in a turbulent Middle East. I'm Ray Suarez for America Abroad.
I am Mithat Bereket in Istanbul. As we heard in the history segment, the Turkish Parliament's 2003 decision not to allow U.S. troops through the country caused a rift between the two nations that continues today. In our eyewitness segment, Rey Suarez explores how domestic pressures in Turkey combined with miscommunications on both sides to strain relations between long-standing allies.
In 2003, U.S. troops invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein. American war planners had originally envisioned a two-pronged attack in which American forces would attack Iraq from both the north and the south. To open a northern front, American officials tried to convince the Turkish government to allow U.S. troops to head into Iraq from Turkey, but the Turkish parliament narrowly voted not to allow American troops through Turkey. That decision reflected Turkish public opinion. After all, over 90% of Turks opposed the war. But it was also a result of misperception and miscommunication between two long-standing allies. Problems between the U.S. and Turkey surfaced over a decade before. In 1991, Turkish President Turgut Özal supported America's efforts to eject Saddam from Kuwait despite strong public opposition to the war.
Baghdad, and the anti-aircraft fire is again going up as the night sky continues to be brightly lighted in Baghdad. Peter.
And when Operation Desert Storm got underway, Turkey allowed U.S. planes to use its bases for their bombing runs. Faruk Loğlu was a senior member of the Turkish Foreign Service. He later became the Turkish ambassador to the United States.
The first Gulf War, the way it ended with Saddam still in power, half-finished job, so to speak, its impact on Turkey was devastating in terms of economic and social consequences. And we lost overnight our second largest trading partner. It's like for the U.S. to lose Canada or Mexico as a trading partner.
It wasn't just the economic effects of the war that caused bitterness in Turkey. During the first Gulf War, almost 500,000 Kurds flowed from northern Iraq into southern Turkey, inflaming Turkey's long-standing problems with its own Kurdish population. Mark Grossman served as U.S. ambassador to Turkey from 1994 to 1997. He later was Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs.
They, of course, lived with that refugee challenge. Huge numbers of Kurds pressing up against the border. The fear that they would spill into Turkey, destabilizing southeastern Turkey. The major effort that was made to get all those people to go home led Turks to believe that one of the things that Western powers wanted to do was create an independent Kurdish state in the north. And as much as we said, no, 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 that's not our policy, I think very few Turks believed that.
In the summer of 2002, rumblings of a new war against Iraq began to be heard in Washington. The Pentagon decided that American forces should open two fronts against Iraq. Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, remembers the initial conversation.
And that became sort of part of our planning. If Turkey would agree to have the 4th Infantry Division come through their country and into northern Iraq, protect the Kurdish population, which could come under fire very quickly, and fix the Iraqi divisions that were in that area and participate in the fight to the south.
Mark Grossman and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz traveled to Turkey in July of 2002 to begin negotiations. Mark Grossman.
Well, what we were asking for was the right for the 4th Infantry Division to land in one part of Turkey, transit across southern Turkey, and go into Iraq. Oh, I think my initial impression is it was going to be really an uphill battle, as it should be. You're asking people to go to war. And so I think we should stop here for a minute and say, you'd be astonished if you went to the Turks and said, hey, how'd you like to do this? And they said, oh, sure. I mean, it would be the height of irresponsibility from their perspective.
During the summer and fall of 2002, Turkish officials faced more immediate concerns. They had to contend with parliamentary elections that coming November. Those elections brought a sea change in Turkish politics. A new party came to power. The Justice and Development Party, or AK, was the successor group to an Islamist party banned by Turkish courts. The chairman of AK was Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He traveled to Washington in December of 2002 and had a cordial first meeting with President Bush.
We're impressed by the leadership, your leadership and your party's strong victory. We thank you very much for your commitment to democracy and freedom.
But there were difficult negotiations ahead. In return for allowing 60,000 U.S. troops to pass through Turkey, the U.S. offered a compensation package to cushion the possible economic impact of the war. John Taylor, the Undersecretary for International Affairs at the U.S. Treasury, was in charge of working out the details of the package. Taylor's first meeting with the Turkish ministers took place the day after President Bush and Erdogan met.
And at that meeting, actually, they asked for, or at least suggested they would need much, much more than what we were talking about, $92 billion. So it was kind of off the scales, and we had to right then begin bringing us back to something more realistic.
For the U.S., what was more realistic was $4 to $6 billion. The Treasury Department believed that was the maximum number Congress would approve. But why were the two sides so far apart? Mark Grossman.
They didn't sit there and say we want $90 billion because they actually thought that we would say, oh, okay. I think they were trying to say to us, would you please get it through your heads that a large number of forces is too big of a number? And so I think when we were focused on what we wanted, they were focused on trying to mitigate the damage of what we wanted. And I think they were trying to kind of wave their arms and say, It's too big. It's all too big.
And there was another reason that Turkey drove such a hard bargain with the U.S. Faruk Loğlu.
I think the assumption which prevailed on the Turkish side at the time was that the U.S. needed Turkey so much that the U.S. would do anything Turkey would ask of the U.S. And that assumption was just not valid.
American officials tried hard to dispel this notion. General Myers had a conversation with the head of the Turkish military, General Özkök.
And I called him and said, don't think this is just an exercise. You know, don't think that if the president orders us to go, that we need you. That by saying no to us, you stop the whole thing in Iraq. That the fact we couldn't have a northern front from a military standpoint wasn't going to stop us. And I wanted him to understand that very clearly.
By the end of December, both sides had laid out their positions. But they weren't close to an agreement, and time was running short. Military schedules dictated that if the U.S. was to move against Saddam, it must do it soon. General Myers.
We were absolutely convinced that the Iraqi regime had weapons of mass destruction, chemical and biological weapons, so we were going to go in our chem gear. To fight in that is very hot. It does have an impact on how well you can fight. You know, so there probably was a sense of urgency.
The AK Party was caught between the competing demands of a longtime ally and intense public opposition to the Iraq war. In mid-February, the Pentagon turned up the heat on Turkey. Faruk Loğlu.
Well, it wasn't just pressure through the diplomatic channels and at the highest level telephone calls and so forth, but it took more concrete form with a number of U.S. Warships carrying American troops coming into Turkish waters, and they spent several weeks there just hanging around waiting for Turkey's decision. And how can you put more pressure on a country except by bringing your ships over there?
In Turkey, public resistance to the war was growing stronger. Widespread anti-war sentiment encouraged the AK Party leaders to demand as much as they could get from the U.S. Mark Grossman.
They had a huge public opinion problem. No Turkish government could stand up and say, hey, we didn't get the money, because every Turk believes that they lost money after the first Gulf War. I don't think that's right, but that's what every single Turkish person believes, bar none. So if you're the Prime Minister of Turkey, you better have a talking point in the press conference about the money that's going to come for the money that you lost.
In February 2003, Turkish ministers were back in Washington, still trying to get an agreement. After unsuccessful visits with Condoleezza Rice and President Bush, they insisted on a late-night meeting with Secretary of State Colin Powell. John Taylor was at that meeting.
We went out to his house in Virginia with the Turks again and went over these, and ultimately he just made it clear that the amounts that they were asking about were many, many times the whole foreign aid budget of the United States government. So they just were not possible to do. And I think it began to sink in at that point.
Shortly thereafter, the AK Party government agreed to the U.S. offer for a flexible aid package worth $6 billion. And on March 1st, the matter came before the Turkish parliament. The AK Party made the decision to allow its party members in parliament to vote their conscience, a risky and unusual move on such a critical issue. The decision gave AK parliamentarians an opening to vote against the deal, and the measure fell 3 votes short of a majority. Many in the U.S. government were angered by the Turkish vote. They argued the young AK Party government had mismanaged the vote. Because of the Turkish decision, only a few thousand U.S. troops were able to parachute in to secure northern Iraq. And when a Sunni insurgency developed after Saddam Hussein's overthrow, many in the U.S. military argued a northern front would have saved American lives. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was interviewed in 2005.
Clearly, if we had been able to get the 4th Infantry Division in from the north through Turkey, more of the Iraqi Saddam Hussein Ba'athist regime would have been captured or killed. The insurgency today would be less.
But Mark Grossman sees a silver lining, the growth of Turkish democracy.
15 years ago or 20 years ago, if you wanted something done in Turkey, a delegation came, they got in cars from the airport, they went over to the Turkish General Staff, they spoke to the Turkish General Staff. If you could convince the Turkish General Staff this is what you wanted to do,
You could be pretty much assured that if that's what you wanted, that's what was going to happen. Well, good for Turkey, good for Turks, I think good for the United States. Turkey's not that way anymore. I mean, I want to be clear, and still a lot more to do in Turkey and democracy. But now you actually have to deal with Turkish politics. You have to make your case. You have to talk to the prime minister. You have to talk to the president. You have to deal with public opinion. You have to deal with parliament. You have to deal with democracy.
The vote in the Turkish parliament caused a rift with the U.S. that's damaged relations between once strong allies. For the U.S., one lesson is that dealing with a more and more democratic Turkey means the U.S. will have to develop a strategy for winning over the Turkish public. If not, a legacy of friendship won't prevent a future of conflict. Coming up, we'll take a look at one of the thorniest problems in the U.S.-Turkish relation, the Kurdish issue. That's ahead on this edition of America Abroad. I'm Ray Suarez, and this is America Abroad. This hour on the program, allies at a crossroad, Turkey and the U.S. The PKK and the Armenian Genocide Resolution are the two major issues likely to determine the course of U.S.-Turkish relations. In October, the House Foreign Affairs Committee stirred the Armenian Genocide controversy.
If a resolution of that sort passes the U.S. Congress, I don't think we would be able to talk about Turkish-American cooperation for a long time.
Egmen Baş is vice chairman of the AK Party and foreign policy advisor to Turkish Prime Minister Erdogan.
The job of a politician is to determine the future by writing laws to create a better future for the next generation. It's the job of a historian to determine what happened in the past.
The resolution has lost support in the House and is unlikely to come to a vote, for now. Still, in response, Turkey threatened to cut off access to the Incirlik Air Base, and Turks are quick to point out that 70% of the military cargo destined for Iraq and Afghanistan passes through that base. A week after the congressional committee vote, the Turkish parliament authorized its military to cross the Iraqi border to take action against the PKK. The Turkish vote is a result of years of frustration over the perceived lack of U.S. action against the PKK in northern Iraq. America has labeled the PKK a terrorist organization, and the U.S. was behind the capture of PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan in 1999. But the Bush administration has been hesitant to accede to Turkish demands for more decisive action, partly out of fear of destabilizing northern Iraq, and partly because the U.S. has few troops to spare in Iraq. Mithat Bereket in Istanbul has covered the Kurds and the PKK for years.
The Kurds have spent centuries under the thumb of one empire or another. Currently dispersed across Turkey, Iraq, Syria, and Iran, the Kurds have a long history of rebellion in the quest for autonomy, if not outright independence. But the Kurds of Turkey, they don't want an independent state. All they want is to have jobs, security, and a normal life. Today, Turkey's 11 million Kurds are increasingly moving from the rural southeast into the cities like Istanbul. In fact, Istanbul today has the largest Kurdish population of any city in the world. And conversations like this one between two young Turkish men are commonplace in Istanbul's many cafes.
There is not a Kurdish problem. There is a little PKK problem. They try to bring it up to a Kurdish problem, but it's not. I think last month, Turkish government found out PKK attacks with American guns. And they said it's not true, it's lie. And a few weeks ago, they said, it's been stolen from the army and there were some people, they did this. America, it has so big power. They know what goes on. They help PKK too. There is lots of games behind of this.
I don't think there is a Kurdish problem. As my friend suggested, there is only PKK problem. We live with Kurdish people for over 1,000 years and they so far never established a country of their own. They are happy with it. This party, DTP, for example, they say good things, but they have second agenda in their mind and they follow the PKK's thinkings. They think they are doing something good for making peace, but they are just killing it.
The DTP is the Kurdish Democratic Society Party. In the last election, 21 independent candidates won seats in parliament. 20 of them declared membership in the DTP. Hilmi Aydoğdu is the head of the DTP in Diyarbakır, a major city in the southeastern part of Turkey. In this predominantly Kurdish city, perspectives on the PKK differ from those in Istanbul.
PKK has been created by the Kurdish issue. PKK is a result, it's not a source. So we have to focus on the Kurdish issue and the solutions to the Kurdish issue. But the authorities prefer to present the problem as if it's the PKK problem, and they want the Kurdish problem to vanish.
The people voted for DTP in the name of honor, pride, in the name of the history of the Kurdish nation.
But for many Kurds today, it takes more than honor, pride and history to motivate them at the ballot box. Gorbet Alton is a 21-year-old student in Diyarbakır. She is a Kurd.
There are only projects, only files, billboards, advertisements. But concretely and in reality, we have never seen anything done to develop in education, in health, in economy, in Diyarbakir by DTP.
In the most recent parliamentary elections, more than 50% of Kurds voted for the ruling AK Party. Sezgin Tanrıkulu is a human rights lawyer and chairman of the Diyarbakir branch of the Turkish Bar Association.
The violent policies which intensified just before the elections by the PKK pushed the public to vote for AKP because the people had been exhausted. They got tired of violent policies or using weapons. The ordinary people living in the region believe in a hope that will be brought by the AKP.
The AK Party seems to be giving more than hope. President Gül visited southeastern Turkey shortly after his election. The government has increased investment in southeastern Turkey, and the AKP supports EU membership. That will require Turkey to make constitutional changes to guarantee minority rights. The AKP and many Turks hope these moves will further diminish support for the PKK. Still, some members of the AK Party feel that soft power is not enough to eliminate the PKK. Egemen Bağış, vice chairman of the AK Party.
PKK terrorists have found themselves a safe haven in the northern part of Iraq. We want the United States to realize that PKK for us is what Al-Qaeda is to you. And if you expect us to fight against Al-Qaeda, which we do, we expect you to fight against PKK with the same determination.
Bağış and others in Turkey argue that America's failure to take action against the PKK is the main reason for the anti-American sentiments in Turkey today. Although Turkey criticizes America for its lack of action, the PKK has been an issue for decades.
What the Turks have to understand that the road to their own domestic stability actually does run through northern Iraq.
Henry Barkey contemplates the issue at a cafe in Bethesda, Maryland. He is professor of international relations at Lehigh University and has studied Turkey and the Kurds for years.
When you look at the relationship between Turkey and the United States, the thing that comes up the most is the presence of the PKK, but in fact that really masks the deep unease the Turks have about the potential Kurdish state.
The PKK was founded as a separatist organization fighting for an independent state in southeastern Turkey. But with the ongoing war in Iraq, there is a possibility that northern Iraq could end up as an independent Kurdish state. Turks fear that could embolden Kurdish separatists in Turkey. Henry Barkey.
There is yet, I would argue, an opportunity here for the Iraqi Kurds, the Turks, and the Americans to make a deal. The one thing we forget about the Kurds is that the Kurds in Iraq are very different than the Iraqi brethren. Iraqi Kurds tend to be secular. Iraqi Kurds tend to be, for historical reasons, pro-Western. Iraqi Kurds actually are more pro-Turkish than they are anything else.
The Kurds in northern Iraq have yet to make any bold moves to eliminate the PKK. Some speculate that Mesut Barzani, president of the Kurdistan Regional Government in Iraq, is using the PKK issue as a bargaining chip to gain concessions from Turkey and the U.S. Robert Pearson served as the U.S. ambassador to Turkey from 2000 to 2003. He argues that, regardless of Barzani's motivation, the parties need to come to the table.
If you were to map a solution out, there has to be effective, concrete, visible action against the PKK. There needs to be greater economic development and political progress with respect to southeastern Turkey. The United States needs to reaffirm that for itself, the alliance with Turkey is a primacy. Fourthly, I would say that then Turkey and Iraq, especially with respect to northern Iraq, need to continue this economic development between the two regions.
And as far as U.S. interests are concerned, that development and progress needs to happen sooner rather than later. Ambassador Pearson hopes the U.S. can avoid a worst-case scenario.
A horrific terrorist incident in Turkey that results in the deaths of hundreds of people that is linked to the PKK and by indirection back to our lack of action. Be very difficult for a government to deal with that in Turkey. And so I think that's the kind of ticking clock that ought to be a serious factor in our own calculation about where U.S. interests lie and what we ought to do.
Given the recent surge in PKK attacks, the Turkish air raids and troop incursions into northern Iraq, and the rest of Turkish public, the ticking finally seems to have the attention of top U.S. officials. For America Abroad, I am Mithat Bereket.
You've been listening to Allies at a Crossroad, Turkey and the U.S. For transcripts and a podcast of this program, visit us on the web at americaabroad.org. Our production team includes Ilana Weinberg, Alex Riley, Amber Finkminer, and David Schulman. Our director of research is Chris Williams. Our senior producers are Sean Carberry and Hermione G. Our director of broadcasting and station relations is Steve Martin. Aaron Lobel is our executive producer. Special thanks to CNN Turk and my co-host in Turkey, Mithat Bereket. I'm Ray Suarez. Join me next month for another edition of America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Support for America Abroad comes from the Ford Foundation, the Carnegie Corporation, the Stewart Family Foundation, the Star Foundation, the Plowshares Fund, the Hewlett Foundation, the Journal of Foreign Affairs, and from The American Interest, a magazine devoted to illuminating America's global role. Support also comes from this and other Public Radio International stations and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
The National Weather Service says today will be cloudy with scattered snow showers, highs around 19 degrees, northwest wind 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to around 35 miles per hour. Tonight, cloudy, scattered flurries in the evening, low around 6 degrees with a northwest wind 15 to 25 miles per hour, gusting to around 30 miles per hour, making the wind chill readings 8 below to 14 below zero. You're listening to AM 580 WILL Urbana.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute at the University of Illinois, hosting a lifelong learning program developed specifically for adults over 50. Additional information on